right, the lunch break is over in the courtroom of Judge Vincent Gaughan for the Jason Van Dyke murder trial. They've just called their next witness. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Have a seat. All right, the chair is adjustable. The microphone's live. Pull your chair up to the mic. Everybody will be able to hear your testimony. It would be greatly appreciated. Proceed, Ms. Wynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Could you please state and spell your name?
Nicholas Pappas, P-A-P-P-A-S.
What is your occupation?
Retired police officer.
Where were you a police officer?
Chicago PD.
How long?
29 years.
Okay. What were your areas of assignment?
Did my field training after the academy in the 19th District out of Belmont Western. That was in 1985. From there, I was transferred to the Rogers Park District at Clark and Devon. I worked there until 1989. Briefly, worked in 17th District out of Sunnyside and Pulaski. And then in September of 89, I was transferred to the Chicago Police Academy to be an instructor. And I worked there until January of 2004 and transferred back to the Rogers Park District and worked there until I retired in May of 2015.
So you were a firearms instructor for 14 years?
Yes, at the academy, yes.
Were you teaching there in 2001?
Yes, I was.
And you're where Jason Van Dyke went through the academy in 2001, correct?
Yes.
Are all recruits required to take your firearms class?
Yes.
And did all firearms instructors teach the same curriculum and utilize the same videos and books as training tools?
Yes, it was in the lesson plans at the time.
Okay. What training or certifications do you have as a firearms instructor?
I was initially certified by the Smith & Wesson Academy in Springfield, Massachusetts, and later by Beretta, Sig Arms, Ruger, finally the Police Training Institute from the University of Illinois, down in Champaign.
Did you develop any firearms training?
Yes.
What?
Develop lesson plans, develop courses of fire, scripted training videos, and wrote several publications.
Do you shoot competitively?
Yes, I have for many years.
Do you have awards for that?
Oh, yes. I've won or placed for awards at the local, statewide, regional, and national level.
Okay. Can you briefly describe the standard curriculum in the Chicago Police Academy for the firearms training class?
Yes. This is the working day. First is firearms orientation. That's in the first week that they're there. It's a four-hour block where the program is covered, what they're going to be learning, what they have to do, what they have to buy. Next time they come into the range, section proper and their gun belts are assembled, and we start working them on the hands-on skills they need in order to pass the courses they have to shoot. Because of the nature of semi-automatic pistols, we had a pretty lengthy run of dry drills where they did hands-on skills but without live ammunition, without live fire. That went on for several weeks. Helped them build up their skills and their endurance so they would be ready for live fire. Then we would start live fire and we would build things up in pace and intensity, getting them ready for their state firearms qualification. And they would qualify for the state of Illinois, and after that they would start shooting combat drills of various sorts where conditions were closer to what they might experience out in the field. Things like very short time durations, very low lighting, multiple targets, and so on.
Did you utilize simulations?
Yes, we had shooting simulators, I believe, starting in 1999. The FATS, or Firearms Training System, we had two of those, which were basically projection television sets hooked to laser disc players, hooked to a computer, hooked to a keyboard, and various live-action scenarios could be projected on the wall that the trainees had to react to and explain what they did afterwards.
Okay. What type of firearm did you train the recruits with?
They were allowed one caliber for their training, 9mm. At the time, there were four approved manufacturers, Smith & Wesson, Beretta, Sig Arms, and Ruger, and they were double-action-only pistols. So every trigger pull worked the same way, about 8 to 10 pounds per trigger pull.
In 2001, what was the required duty weapon for the Chicago Police Department?
Again, a 9mm pistol of those makes, with anywhere from most of the ones were actually 15-shot capacity, 15-shot magazines.
In 2004, what was the required duty weapon?
I don't believe that had changed by that time, no.
And is it the same today?
No, that has changed. They now are into different manufacturers, I believe, Glock and Springfield Armory, and I don't even know who else right now.
What is a semi-automatic gun?
A semi-automatic pistol is a handgun that is fed from a box magazine in the handle or grip. And that magazine holds cartridges or rounds of ammunition, and the weapon is recoil operated. In other words, once the first round has been manually fed from the magazine into the chamber, pulling the trigger will cause the weapon to cycle. And the cycle of operation is feed, fire, extract, eject. So if you have a round in the chamber and a loaded magazine, the first trigger pull is going to fire the round in the chamber. The slider top end of the weapon reciprocates. As it does that, the fire casing remaining in the chamber is extracted, ejected, and the spring-loaded slide is driven forward, stripping the next round out of the magazine and feeding it into the chamber, and wait for the next trigger pull. Because it's semi-automatic, that means one shot per trigger pull. Full automatic, you would just hold the trigger back and that thing would just keep rolling. That would be machine gun fire, but that's not what we use.
Okay. Thank you. Are you aware that Jason Van Dyke's gun held 15 rounds and one in the chamber?
Yes.
And is that an authorized amount of ammunition?
Yes.
Okay. Taught in the academy as to how many rounds of magazines police officers should carry?
The general order required at least one spare magazine carried on the person, so you would have a fully loaded weapon, meaning a full magazine around the chamber, and at least one full spare magazine. Most people carry two spare magazines on duty, and we required at least two spare magazines for their firearms training in order to expedite their shooting of the courses that they had to shoot.
And why were they required to carry an extra magazine?
Simply because out in the field you don't know how many rounds you're going to need to win a fight, how many rounds it's going to take to settle a problem.
Taught in the academy regarding training when an officer has fired all the rounds in his or her gun and the gun has gone into slide lock.
In slide lock, the weapon should be immediately reloaded. They were trained and drilled on that from the very beginning. To stand there with an empty weapon is to invite a big problem. So reloads were drilled until they were immediately done. And it wasn't just shooting till a slide locked. The weapon could also be reloaded before slide lock. People were taught that if there's a break in the action and it comes to mind, reload then. And that can be done two ways. You can retain the magazine from the weapon or you can dump it to the ground. But what you're doing is you're getting a fully loaded magazine into the weapon while there's a round remaining in the chamber. So you don't even have to work the slide.
Can you just explain what slide lock means?
Slide lock means you have fired all the rounds in the weapon, and when the last cartridge case is extracted and ejected from the weapon, a catch on the magazine causes the slide to lock all the way open. And that gives you the visual indication that there is nothing left in the weapon. When that slide is all the way back and you can look inside and see top of the magazine, that means there's nothing there. And at that point, if you have a fresh magazine, you should be reloading.
Immediately reloading?
Yes.
What was taught with respect to police officers dealing with a deadly force situation?
That was covered after qualification, because everything up through qualification had to deal with the fundamentals of shooting and shooting accurately. After qualification, when we were shooting the combat drills, now we start talking real world and what you have to do to defend yourself, what you have to do to protect the community, and that's where people were told that you need to be able to shoot much more rapidly than what you did in state qualification. You need to shoot more rapidly, and you had to keep the hits in the scoring area. Ultimately, you had to shoot as quickly as you could keep your hits in the scoring area is what we wanted.
What about when you're dealing with a real-life situation?
Same thing. You shoot until the threat is eliminated, and there's no telling what that could be. No telling how many rounds it could take to do that. Pistols are low power weapons compared to rifles and carbines and shotguns, and it can often take any number of hits in order to stop a fight.
Was there any instruction in the academy or in your classes regarding knife attacks?
Yes, that's something too we covered again after qualification when we got into the combat exercises. People were told that knives are deadly weapons, bludgeons are deadly weapons, and you have to treat them accordingly. In fact, a knife can't, within a certain distance and pace, a knife is more deadly than a gun simply because it will go through soft body armor. The soft body armor that officers were issued will not stop a knife in a thrust.
So is a bulletproof vest soft body armor?
Yes, yes.
And a knife can go through that?
Yes, the soft body armor is designed to stop bullets, not knives.
Did you show videos in the academy depicting knife attacks on police officers?
Yes, we did.
Have you heard of the 21-foot rule?
Yes, that too is something that we definitely spoke about. What the 21-foot rule has to do with is the distance and time of a threat. In other words, a standard combat shooting distance is 7 yards or 21 feet. And the question was asked many years ago, well, how quickly could someone cover 7 yards or 21 feet and use an impact weapon like a knife or a club? And when tests were done to see how long it took, the average, amazingly, was about 1.5 seconds. And even people with leg injuries were doing it in under 2 seconds. And that's with the officer and the offender separated by 21 feet and both starting with no movement whatsoever. If you start cutting that distance or have the offender already in motion, by that time becomes quite a bit less.
What was taught in the academy, or could you explain action versus reaction?
What that has to do with is if an officer waits for an offender to take an action, then the officer is at a time disadvantage as far as responding to the action. So the notion there is that if there is a justified response, the officer should act first. If you wait, if you act as a reaction, again, you're behind the curve. So again, action beats reaction.
Can I have a moment, please?
Cross-examination, Mr. Wild.
Thank you, Judge. It's going to take you 1 second to set up.
Take your time.
Thank you. Mr. Pappas, you had indicated that you actually put together the materials that the recruits were trained on, correct?
Yes, I had. I did lesson plans as well as other things, yes.
Okay. And that included the time that Jason Van Dyke was at the academy, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you taught them that what they learned from you can't be taken in isolation, correct?
Could you rephrase that?
Okay.
Let me explain something. No matter if it's defense or prosecution, if they ask you a question that you don't understand, as you just stated, you have a right to have the attorney explain that question. All right. Rephrase.
They have to utilize what they learn from you and integrate it with what they use in their use of force training from the law unit, correct?
Certainly.
Okay. And also with their tactical training from the operations unit, correct?
Yes.
It's all a global training.
Yes.
Okay. And through the academy, the defendant was taught about the importance of making correct decisions when it comes to utilizing his firearm, correct?
Yes.
And this is the deadliest weapon that he carries, correct?
Yes.
And the defendant is taught that there can be criminal and civil consequences for misusing that weapon, correct?
Yes.
And he's taught to utilize his firearm with restraint, correct?
Yes.
You talked a little bit about the requirement that the firearm be double action only, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And why is it that there's a requirement that it be double action only?
Simpler to operate, consistent trigger pull, and don't have to deal with a single action weapon, a cocked weapon.
Okay. Is it also because you don't want unintentional firing?
Yes, it has to do with the fact that it's a weapon that cannot be cocked or lifted in single-action condition. A cocked hammer means a lighter trigger pull, shorter, lighter trigger pull.
Right. And so these weapons take 8 to 12 pounds for each trigger pull, correct?
Typically, yes.
Is there also a requirement that they, or was there a requirement when Jason Van Dyke was in the academy, that they receive a certification from the range instructor if they're using a high-capacity magazine?
No.
And one of the things that you hammer into the defendant when you're training him is the importance of distance, correct?
Yes.
Okay. It's really stressed throughout different portions of your training, correct?
It's part of the training, yes.
And you taught the defendant the importance of keeping distance from offenders, correct?
When possible, when feasible.
Okay. And you would never teach a recruit to unnecessarily close the distance on someone he or she perceived as a threat, correct?
It depends on the threat. It depends on the situation. It can be necessary to close the distance to control the person.
My question was unnecessarily.
I would say unnecessarily, sure.
And the defendant was also taught to use barricades and shielding in his training, correct?
That was part of it, yes.
In fact, this is so important that the defendant was specifically rated on his use of shielding throughout the course, correct?
That was only commented on during courses where the barricade was used or during the shooting simulations.
So is your answer yes?
For those circumstances, yes.
And in fact, he was taught that shielding is one of the most important factors to officer survival in a use of lethal force situation, correct?
Certainly, when facing a firearm, you want to be behind something that preferably will stop a bullet.
Okay. And specifically, he was taught that vehicle body panels can provide adequate protection if the threat is a handgun, correct?
It can.
Well, he's taught that. He was taught that, correct?
Yes.
Now, that would also go to a 3-inch blade, correct? A body panel would protect an officer from a 3-inch blade, correct?
Yes.
And another factor in the decision to shoot is time, correct?
Yes, time is a factor.
Okay. And if you can buy time to wait for support, that would be a good thing to do, correct?
Generally, yes.
And you taught the defendant that something that an officer is supposed to look for once they make the decision to shoot is rapid collapse, correct?
When a person fires, they have to evaluate whether they should keep going or not, yes.
Okay. And one indication is rapid collapse, correct?
It can be. Okay. Not necessarily, but it can be.
Can you explain what rapid collapse is?
That's when the offender falls to the ground.
Okay. And that shows that the officer's shot has had some effects on the offender, correct?
Maybe yes, maybe no.
Well, explain yourself.
People duck and move for other reasons than they were incapacitated.
Okay, but the shot is the reason that they hit the ground, whether it hit them or not, right? So the shot had an effect on them.
Yeah, but ducking and moving is not incapacitation.
But it had an effect, correct?
You would say it had an effect.
Your Honor, with your permission, I'd ask to show a clip of People's Exhibit 8, just very briefly, starting at the 41 second and 15 30th point.
Wait one moment. Mm-hmm. Okay. Come on. It's not on this one.
It's coming. There it is. It's coming.
Is that on?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're all good, Judge.
Thank you.
That was rapid collapse, correct?
He went down, yes.
Once rapid collapse is accomplished, the defendant was taught that he has to reassess the situation to determine whether more shots are warranted, correct?
That depends on the officer's perspective, which we're not seeing here.
Mr. Pappas, you had testified that you created materials related to training Officer Van Dyke, correct?
Yes.
Specifically say in those materials, for an officer forced to fire, the necessary response is to fire until the offender leaves your sight picture or surrenders, correct?
Yeah, I wrote that.
The defendant was also taught that in any confrontation, when officer safety will not be compromised, verbal commands should be given, correct?
It's a good thing, usually.
And if an officer decides that verbal commands are the appropriate response, something would have to change in order for deadly force to now be the appropriate response, correct? There would have to be some change in the circumstance? Be uncommon for a subject to look at an officer as he's shouting commands at him, correct?
That depends on the condition of the person. That cannot be assumed.
The defendant was taught that it's important to avoid overreaction where results unnecessarily endanger bystanders, fellow officers, and non-threatening suspects, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
And you'd agree with me that the decision to shoot is an important one that an officer makes, correct?
Yes.
And the decision to stop shooting is also extremely important, correct?
Yes.
The defendant wasn't taught to just empty his magazine once he makes the decision to shoot, correct?
He was taught to shoot rapidly. He was taught to neutralize the threat.
Okay. And when you say neutralize the threat, you don't mean neutralize the life, do you?
I mean stop the fight. Make sure that the person is incapacitated. Make sure that the person cannot hurt someone.
Specifically, the defendant was taught that most shootings only last 2 to 3 seconds, correct?
That's typical, but there are exceptions.
And that includes gunfights, correct?
Yes.
He's also taught that most shootings are 1 to 6 rounds, correct?
Yep, but there have been exceptions to that, too.
But he is taught to constantly reassess the situation to determine whether firing is still an appropriate response, correct?
He's taught to fire until the threat is neutralized. Yes, there's going to be a reevaluation at some point, but you have to be sure that the threat is stopped.
Mr. Pappas, are you familiar with the term general order?
Yes.
And could you explain what a general order is?
General order is some rules from the department on how procedures were to be done.
Okay, and it's an order that covers everyone, correct?
And there are orders on all kinds of things, yes.
And they're important, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And everything that you included in your training materials, that's also important, correct?
Yes.
And so if a general order is included in your training materials, it's doubly important because it's, one, a general order, and two, included in your materials, correct?
Yes.
And you did include in your materials for the defendant a general order entitled Protection of Life Policy, correct?
Yes.
And that policy states that an officer is not allowed to use deadly force to prevent an arrest from being defeated by resistance or escape merely because the offense committed or attempted is categorized as a forcible felony, correct?
Yes, but I'm not an expert on the law.
But this is what you taught, correct?
Yes.
And this is what you taught the defendant?
Again, the range staff did not teach deadly force policy. There were attorneys up in the academy that did that. We touched on it only to the extent that was necessary for the shooting simulations. That was it.
This is in your material, so, correct?
Yes.
And that policy also states that an officer is only allowed to use deadly force to prevent the defeat of the arrest by resistance or escape when the person to be arrested is using a firearm, correct?
I believe that's what it said at the time.
And the general order, which was important enough to include in your training materials, also makes it clear that police officers may resort to the lawful use of firearms only after all other reasonable means at their disposal to effect apprehension and control of an individual have been attempted without success, correct?
Yes.
They're also taught through those materials, the defendant was taught through those materials, that the use of a firearm in any case is a last resort measure, correct?
That's the words of the order.
No further questions.
A police officer's intent in shooting is to eliminate the threat, right?
Yes.
It's not to kill? No?
Not necessarily, no.
It's not to injure?
No.
It's to stop the threat to himself?
Objection, Judge, the intent of every police officer. Sustained, rephrase.
I'll withdraw it. When an officer is lacking shielding and distance, they're in a much more vulnerable position, isn't that right?
Yes.
And they may be forced to fire quicker if they do not have shielding, right?
Yes.
If they do not have a safe distance.
Yes.
Tell me about when an assailant is on the ground. Is he still considered a threat?
It certainly can be, yes.
Why?
Because they could get up and reattack.
Because why?
They could get up.
I didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
Why? Mr. Pappas, do you know? Remember the question?
Yes.
All right. Answer it, please.
Because they could get up and reattack.
Thank you. You were asked about general orders that are policy,
yes.
Right? The general orders aren't the law, are they?
No.
Okay. And policy is more restrictive than the law, isn't it?
Typically, yes.
I have nothing else.
Not either. Thank you. You can step down. Appreciate that. Could I have the attorneys over here for scheduling, please?
We understand is the last witness. That witness has been crossed, that has gone through cross-examination. We have with us now Michael Oppenheimer with Erickson and Oppenheimer. He's an experienced defense and criminal, prosecution and criminal defense attorney, and you've actually tried cases in front of this very Judge Vincent Gaughan. Let's talk about the last speaker, this expert who is in charge of firearms training at the police academy. He said that you're supposed to act first if there's a threat, but, quote, if you want, wait for action, you're behind the curve, which is implying that, you know, officers have very little time to size up the situation and take action.
That's generally true, except there is a whole plethora of officers already there that were assessing the situation. That's why they called for a taser car. Officer Van Dyke would have known that at the time because he would have been monitoring the radio. So the situation has already been assessed. So there are some holes in that. I would generally agree with that principle. You don't want to be behind the curve, but he would have already known what the situation was.
Seemed like he was very effectively cross-examined by the prosecution.
He was. I would think that they should have been a little bit more in his face about, they were talking about threat assessment, and you fire till the threat is ended. And when Laquan McDonald is down on the ground after having obviously been shot numerous times, they should have asked him, well, how is he a threat? The threat is over. When you're down on the ground, the threat is over. He can say, no, it's not, but the threat was over.
Now, an expert who was a former police officer, you would, and it seemed to be implied in his reluctance to more forcefully answer certain prosecutorial questions, does have a bias. He was a man in blue himself. He's retired now.
Absolutely. He spent his entire career with the Chicago Police Department. He taught Jason Van Dyke how to fire a weapon, how to do this. And now Jason Van Dyke is on trial for murder. There is a bias there that the prosecution should have attacked and gone after him, and I didn't see that happen.
He was to show that Van Dyke was not a wild shooter, though. They went through a lot of detail in the beginning about his training at the hands of this particular man, and you got the sense that certainly he was not a wild shooter, but they were trying to present him as a trained professional.
Correct. And they were trying to say that he followed the rules. This is what he was trained to do. That's been their whole theory, that he was trained to do what he was trained to do, and that this is all Laquan McDonald's fault. But the video, the 16 shots, Laquan McDonald being down on the ground and puffs of smoke are coming from his body, show that he deviated from that, to say the least.
Would you still say that the centerpiece of the prosecution's case is hinging on that video?
I think it is. I think it has to be. I think that they didn't attack him enough on when he said you should reassess the situation, which means when he goes down to the ground, you should take a little time, reassess the threat before you fire again. And they did. They could have hit that harder. They did hit that a little
particularly
bit.
Particularly if the perpetrator has it's a knife that individual has and not a gun, which is the far higher threat.
Absolutely true. That 21-foot rule, I mean, he's down on the ground with his knife. He is not standing there anymore pointing it anywhere. So, yes, the threat is greatly diminished.
Though certain officers did testify that upon arrival at the scene here, as these vehicles are doing at this very moment almost 4 years ago, they didn't know that it was just a knife. There was some speculation he might also have a gun. It wasn't really clear yet, even though there was the truck driver who had called in saying a man with a knife had harassed me and lunged at me, though that person was never connected to being Laquan McDonald. But still, they're saying they weren't fully sure. So there's a sense there that they're being extra cautious.
And that's quite possible. There are many people in this city that have knives and guns, and officers know that, and it makes for a dangerous situation. So that point does go to them, for sure.
Would you put Laquan McDonald on the stand?
Van Dyke?
Jason Haddock, yeah.
I think that you put your experts on, and then you have to decide. The general golden rule, 99 out of 100 times, is you never put your client on the stand. You never subject him to that cross-examination, which should be blistering. So they have to be concerned about that. If they think they've scored enough points to create reasonable doubt, which they may have done, and they've scored a lot through Walsh and other experts, then you do not put them on the stand. But that's a decision that they will have to spend this weekend deciding.
And in terms of other witnesses, we do know that in opening arguments, it was presented that they would show certain aspects of the state of mind that an officer has coming into a tense situation, how your reaction completely changes when there is a what's perceived to be a hostile threat with a weapon, and how that all can color how you react to a situation like this.
I would think that would help them a lot, and it helps them to not put Van Dyke on the stand, but that can be explained through another expert to show why he fired the 16 times, what was going through his mind at the time, the danger that he felt for himself and others. That's their whole point. And if they can do that without putting Van Dyke on the stand, that may be the way to go.
Michael Oppenheimer with Erickson and Oppenheimer. Thank you so much.
Very good insights.
Happy to be back next week, perhaps?
Absolutely.
I'll be here Monday. Maybe you will be, too. All right. Great. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break right now. What it will do is get you caught up on the news, a little weather, and then we'll move on for the rest of the day here on CLTV.